Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Globe Gazette for June 16th, 2022, on a Thursday. And I am your reader, Peter Welch. Iowa State, Iowa last state to criminalize elder abuse. Reynolds signs law that advocates have pressed for years. In Williamsburg, with strokes of several pens. Wednesday, Iowa will become the last state in the nation, to criminalize elder abuse. Governor Kim Reynolds signed into law Senate File 522, which sets criminal charges ranging from misdemeanors to felonies punishable by up to 25 years in prison based on the severity of the crime for abusing, assaulting, or financially exploiting a person age 60 or older. Reynolds signed the bill during a ceremony at Highland Ridge Senior Living Community in Williamsburg. After years of advocates pressing for action, the bill passed unanimously in both legislative chambers in the 2022 sessions. The safety and well-being of older Iowans is very important, and this bill provides greater reassurance that there will be consequences for those who are target and harm them. Reynolds said, "Iowa families and seniors deserve to know that we will not stand for any type of elder abuse or exploitation in our state. At least 1 in 10 Americans, age 60 and older, experience elder abuse each year nationwide. According to FBI data and the National Council on Aging, previously Iowa was the only state in the nation where elder abuse was not a crime. Iowa law currently includes definition of elder abuse but does not include criminal penalties because it has not been a crime in Iowa. Accurate data about the prevalence of elder abuse in the state is hard to ascertain, advocates say. However, Iowa has seen a sharp increase in reports of abuse or neglect of dependent adults age 18 or older, including older Iowans. The Iowa Department of Human Services, which does not keep its own statistics on elder abuse, noted a nearly 26% increase in independent adult abuse reports from 2020 to 2021, with more than 10,900 reported cases of alleged abuse or neglect. However, more than half those reports were rejected by the department because they did not fit within the existing legal definition that mandates the victim be classified as a dependent adult and the perpetrator be an official caretaker, according to the department's semiannual dependent adult statistical reports. A total of more than 8,600 cases were reported in 2020, more than 3,950 of which were rejected. Just from July to December of last year, 5,800 dependent adult abuse cases were reported to Human Services, a 25% increase compared with 2019. And of those, more than half of the reported cases were rejected. The bill signed by Reynolds would fix that gap and better protect all older Iowans from abuse, according to AARP Iowa. AARP Iowa has advocated for elder abuse legislation for several years, and we know that this new law will be an important tool for helping put a stop to existing abuse and hopefully preventing it in the future, AARP Iowa Advocacy Manager Anthony Carroll said. About 17.5% of Iowa's populations is 65 years or older, and an estimated approximately 66,000 Iowans are living with Alzheimer's as of 2020, up from 64,000 in 2018, according to the Iowa Department of Public Health. That number is projected by the Alzheimer's Association to grow to 73,000 by 2025. State Senator Kevin Kinney, Democrat of Oxford, said that the new law will give Iowa law enforcement and financial institutions better tools to stop and prevent elder abuse. Kinney is a member of the Iowa Senate Judiciary Committee and a former deputy county sheriff who handled elder abuse cases in Johnson County. Making those who abuse our elders criminally liable will better protect older Iowans, Kinney said in a statement. As a deputy sheriff, I helped investigate several cases of elder abuse. Sometimes the punishments under Iowa law fell seriously short of both providing justice for the victim and deterring future crimes. I'm glad to have helped take this bipartisan step forward. Advocates say that elder abuse is often hidden and involves financial theft in some way, but can also include physical, emotional, or sexual abuse. Elder abuse can be committed by strangers, but is more likely to involve family members or other people's trusted by the victim, according to AARP Iowa. The new law, which takes effect on July 1st, will enhance criminal penalties for second and subsequent assaults against older individuals and requires mandatory minimum sentences. It increases penalties for thefts from older individuals, adds an additional civil penalty for consumer fraud committed against a person who is 60 years or older, creates a new crime of elder abuse that includes physical and emotional abuse, neglected isolation, or sexual exploitation against a person 60 years of age or older who is unable to protect himself or herself from elder abuse as a result of a mental or physical condition or because of a personal circumstance which results in an increased risk of harm to the person. Reynolds also signed a proclamation Wednesday declaring this week as World Elder Abuse Awareness Week in Iowa. Now, the work begins, says Bob of Welsh of Coralville, a member of the Older Iowans legislature, who has long pushed to change the law. We need to educate people on the law. This next story, there's a picture, and the caption reads, "Weird Weather." East Park was closed on Wednesday after torrential rains hit North Iowa. Storms rolled in Tuesday night after a hot, muggy day in the 90s, making way for temps in the 60s on Wednesday. But sunny weather and high temperatures are back in the forecast for the weekend and beyond. HD Cal's Letow to retire at month's end. Superintendent has led district for 15 years. For 32 years, Todd Letow has been taking his father's advice, teaching students something and making them want to come back. The Hampton-Dumont School District has been led by the superintendent for 15 years now. Five of those years include Letow leading the Coulter Alexander Latimer, which stands for CAL, school district as well. But at the end of June, Letow is pursuing a new chapter in life, retirement. "It's just been an honor to be a part of this for so long," said Letow. "I think the trend is that administrators don't stay in one place for too long. It's just been an honor to be part of this because I think I'm just so proud of how the teachers do what it takes to get the job done." Letow announced he would be retiring after the 2021 school year in July of last year. Lisbon High School Principal Aaron Becker will be stepping into the Hampton-Dumont superintendent role on July 1st. Cal School District will be led by Dr. John Robbins, a retired superintendent, as an interim. The superintendent said that he was inspired by his father, longtime Mason City High School band director Gil Latow, to work in education. The younger Latow's first education position was a middle school band director in the Chariton Community School District. Latow said that those first years in education taught him the advantage of strong relationships, a lesson he would apply as an administrator. Once you get to know kids, they'll work for you and try to succeed. Then, if things aren't going well, you know how to encourage and how to build them back up, said Latow. I think that's the whole key to anybody that's successful in education, is to try to build relationships, either with their peers or parents. Latow went to Drake University for his graduate degree, then became a middle school principal at Chariton. Chariton was also where Latow became interested in administrator roles. Somewhere along the line, I had some issues with an administrator. Something clicked in my mind that, you know what, I could probably be a better administrator than that, Latow said. Later, he would become a secondary principal for Martinsdale St. Mary's School District, which sometimes had him in a part-time band director role while the district searched for someone. After completing coursework, Latow's next move was becoming superintendent for North Spring Rock Falls School District. North Springs Rock Falls and North Central School District would become Central Springs in 2007. The same year, Latow was selected as the next superintendent of Hampton Dumont School District. And let's now go to some other news in the U.S. In Washington, Federal Reserve attacks inflation with big rate bump. Increases biggest since 1994 may be followed by more. The Federal Reserve intensified its fight against high inflation on Wednesday, raising its key interest rate by 0.75 point, the largest bump since 1994, and signaling more rate hikes ahead as it tries to cool off the U.S. economy without causing a recession. The unusually large rate hike came after data released Friday showed the U.S. inflation rose last month to a four-decade high of 8.6%, a surprise jump that made financial markets uneasy about how the Fed would respond. The Fed's benchmark short-term rate, which affects many consumer and business Iowans, or business loans rather, will now be pegged to a range of 1.5% to 1.75%. And Fed policymakers forecast a doubling of that range by year's end. We thought strong action was warranted at this meeting, and we deliver that, Fed Chair Jay Powell said at a press conference in which he stressed the central bank's commitment to do what it takes to bring inflation back down to the Fed's target rate of 2%, even if that resulted in a slightly higher unemployment rate. Powell said it was imperative to go bigger than the half-point increase that the Fed had earlier signaled because inflation was running hotter than anticipated, causing particular hardship on low-income Americans, and solidifying the public's view that stubbornly high inflation won't be easily resolved. Powell said that another 0.75 point hike is possible at the Fed's next meeting in late July if inflation pressures remain high, although he said such increases would not be common. He said that the economy is strong enough to endure higher rates without tipping into recession, a prospect that many economists are increasingly worried about. Some financial analysts suggested Powell struck the right balance to reassure markets, which rallied on Wednesday. He hit it hard that we want to get inflation down, but also hit hard that we want a soft landing, said Robert Tipp, chief investment strategist of PGIM Fixed Income. Still, the Fed's action on Wednesday was an acknowledgement that it's struggling to limit the pace and persistence of inflation, which is being fueled by a strong labor market, pandemic-related supply disruptions, and soaring energy prices that have been aggravated by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Some analysts said that they welcomed the Fed's more aggressive posture. The more the Fed does now, the less they will have to do later, said Thomas Garriston, son, senior portfolio strategist at RCB Wealth Management. Matthew Luzzitti, chief U.S. economist at Deutsche Bank and Powell, was right to acknowledge that the faster push on rates will cause pain for consumers. It's going to be a far bumpier ride to get inflation down than what they had anticipated previously, Luzzitti said. Meanwhile, U.S. retail sales slipped 0.3% last month, down from a revised 0.7% increase in April, the Commerce Department said on Wednesday. A sharp decline in auto sales, largely because of higher prices and shortages of new car inventories, depressed the retail sales figure. Excluding autos, retail sales actually rose 0.5% last month. But excluding sales from gas stations, retail sales slipped 0.7%, showing how higher prices at the pump are accounting for more of shoppers' overall spending. The report also highlighted shoppers' pullback on some of the products that were in hot demand during the height of the pandemic, but are now falling out of favor. And now let's take a look at today in history. Today is Thursday, June 16th, the 167th day of 2022. There are 198 days left in the year. Today's highlight. On June 16th, 1858, accepting the Illinois Republican Party's nomination for the U.S. Senate, Abraham Lincoln said the slavery issue had to be resolved, declaring, "A house divided against itself cannot stand." On this date in 1903, Ford Motor Company was incorporated. In 1933, the National Industrial Recovery Act became law with Franklin Delano Roosevelt's signature. The act was later struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation was founded as President Roosevelt signed the Banking Act of 1933. In 1941, National Airport, now Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport, opened for business with a ceremony attended by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. In 1963, the world's first female space traveler, Valentina Tereshkova, 26, was launched into orbit by the Soviet Union board Vostok 6. Tereshkova spent 71 hours in flight, circling the Earth 48 times before returning safely. In 1970, Kenneth A. Gibson of Newark, New Jersey, became the first black politician elected mayor of a major Northeast city. Chicago Bears running back Brian Piccolo, age 26, died at a New York hospital after battling cancer. In 1977, Soviet Communist Party General Secretary Leonid Brezhnev was named president, becoming the first person to hold both posts simultaneously. In 1978, President Jimmy Carter and Panamanian leader Omar Torrijos signed the instruments of ratification for the Panama Canal treaties during a ceremony in Panama City. In other news, Iowa Board of Regents considers tuition hike. The Iowa Board of Regents proposed a 4.25% tuition increase for all three state universities for the coming school year, following an unexpected low 1.1% increase in funding from the Iowa legislature. The board meets Monday to consider the tuition change. With only an extra $5.5 million in state aid added to their budget, the tuition increase could have been as high as 5.6%, according to the Higher Education Price Index model used by the Board of Regents to project the effects of inflation on education. If approved, the proposed tuition increase is projected to generate $35 million in incremental revenue for fiscal year 2023, just over 2% of the current operating budget. In-state undergraduate students at the University of Iowa would pay an additional $355 a semester, while Iowa State University students would see a $354 increase, and the University of Northern Iowa's tuition would increase by $331 under the proposal. The Iowa Board of Regents also increased tuition for Iowa public universities in 2021. Originally, the Iowa House passed an education budget with no additional funding for the three universities and instead proposed a $12 million scholarship program aimed at students pursuing high-demand jobs in combating the teacher shortage, which ultimately failed. The proposed increase comes after years of cuts and status quo funding. In 2021, the state took $7 million from the Regents' budget and left funding flat for fiscal year 2022. This year, the Regents requested an additional $15 million from the state. Base tuition for in-state graduate and professional students would also go up by 4.25% under the proposal. Tuition for out-of-state undergraduates at the University of Iowa will go up by 1.17%, while non-resident graduate student tuition will increase by 1.51%. Specific graduate programs at the University of Iowa and ISU have also proposed increases for the board to consider. These increases, in isolated, are not in addition to the 4.25% increase. ISU students would pay the highest increase in student fees, shelling out an additional $145 to cover mental health services, modernization of technology, and public transportation. Meanwhile, student fees at the University of Northern Iowa would go up by $27, and the University of Iowa would increase by $56. Generally, student fees pay for additional student services such as healthcare, recreational services, and technology. Student fee increases are proposed by each university for the board's consideration. The tuition hike aims to offset rising inflation in the terms of collective bargaining. The generated revenue will cover needed maintenance for academic facilities and support student financial aid programs. The Iowa Board of Regents will meet virtually at 10 a.m. Monday for the first time reading of the proposal and allow for comments from student body presidents of each university. The live stream link can be accessed from the Iowa Board of Regents website. Iowa Capital's Dispatch is part of State's Newsroom, a network of news bureaus supported by grants and a coalition of donors as a 501c3 public charity. Iowa Capital Dispatch maintains editorial independence. And my goodness, it's already Thursday, so it's time to look at the North Iowa area escapades. Here are just a few of the events and shenanigans and goings-on worth checking out this week in the North Iowa area. We will begin by looking at Friday, June 17th, And also through Sunday, June 19th, it's the Classic Car Tour in Clear Lake and Forest City. The Iowa Hawkeye chapter of the Studebaker Drivers Club will be in the Clear Lake and Forest City area June 17th through the 19th. The chapter is chartered under the International Studebaker Drivers Club and has been active since 1972. With members all over the state and beyond, they hold two tours a year and monthly meetings throughout the state. Studebaker vehicles from the 1950s and 60s will be on this tour. The public is welcome to visit the members and their vehicles. The Saturday tour includes a drive from Clear Lake through Fertile and an afternoon display at Pilot Knob State Heritage Park in Forest City. They will be displayed at Heritage Park with the Oliver Hart Tractor National Summer Show. Anyone interested in Studebakers and the company's history are welcome to join the chapter. And then we've got lots of things happening on Saturday, June 18th. Live music, Bruce Day at Tapped. Bruce brings his loop style up from Des Moines to play you all your rock, country, and pop hits. Compared very closely to Ed Sheeran, there isn't much this guy can't play. Listen to live music every Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at Tapped in Clear Lake at 9 p.m. We Bought a Zoo at Algona High School Stadium. Free movie, We Bought a Zoo, playing on the new large scoreboard at Algona High School Stadium at sunset, approximately 9 p.m. Bring your chairs and blankets, free popcorn provided, concessions open for beverages and snacks, sponsored by Algona Chamber in partnership with Algona Community Schools. And in other events, for Saturday, Art Bugs at Charles H. McNider Museum. Instructor Laura will teach the June Art Bugs classroom on Saturday, June 18th, from 10 to 11 a.m. at the McNider Art Museum. This art class is geared toward the smallest of artists as they explore a variety of mediums. Children must be accompanied by a caregiver. The course fee is $12. And also on Saturday, the 18th, Pritchard's Car Show and Cruise. Come show your cars at Pritchard's. Registration is from 8 to 10:30 a.m. with 32 awards to be given starting at 2 p.m., including Best Oldie and Best to Present. There's a $15 entry fee. Free hamburgers, hot dogs, and apple pie are available, as well as goodie bags. A cruise will take place following the awards. Also, breakfast on the veranda at the Charles City Arts Center. Skip the cooking and the dishes. Enjoy a home-cooked Southern breakfast on the charming veranda while supporting the arts. $20 per ticket. Two seating times available. Early bird at 9 a.m. and sleepyhead at 10:30 a.m. Also on Saturday, auditions for summer play at St. Patrick's Catholic Church. The Franklin County Arts Council will be auditioning for roles in its summer theater production, Getting Sarah Married. Director Nathan Prale and Assistant Director Donna Speedy will be holding auditions at St. Patrick's Catholic Church. Six adult roles are being auditioned, three men and three women for a production in early August. Stagehands, set designs, and other interested production parties should also come to auditions or express their interest from 6 to 8 p.m. And then on Sunday, June 19th, Sunday Slow Roll at Wayne's Ski and Cycle. Sunday Slow Roll is back. Hosted by Wayne Ski and Cycle, this fun casual bike ride begins and ends at Wayne downtown and will take a different route through town each week. The total distance will be 8 to 10 miles. Family and friendly paced ride starts at 5 p.m. each week. Food will be available. All are welcome to attend. There are a number of other events that are going on, and all you need to do is to turn to the North Iowa Area Escapades section of the paper to read on other events coming up this and next week. There are no obituary readings today, so we're going to continue with the nation and the world. There's a photo picture, and on the caption it says, U.S. to send $1 billion in military aid to Ukraine. Paramedics push an elderly woman on a gurney into a specialty-equipped medical train run by Doctors Without Borders on Wednesday in Pokrovsk and Donetsk region in Ukraine. The U.S. announced Wednesday it will send an additional $1 billion in military aid to Ukraine, as America and its allies provide long-range weapons they say can make a difference in a fight where Ukrainian forces are outnumbered and outgunned by the Russian invaders. Meanwhile, the Russian military said it used long-range missiles Wednesday to destroy a depot in the western Lviv region of Ukraine, where ammunition for NATO-supplied weapons was stored. And the governor of a key eastern city acknowledged that Russian forces are advancing in heavy fighting. In News Digest, Biden to oil refiners, produce more gas. President Joe Biden on Wednesday called on the U.S. oil refiners to produce more gasoline and diesel, saying their profits have tripled during a time of war between Russia and Ukraine, as Americans struggle with record high prices at the pump. The crunch that families are facing deserves immediate action, Biden wrote in a letter to seven oil refiners. Your companies need to work with my administration to bring forward concrete near-term solutions that address the crisis. Gas prices nationwide are averaging roughly $5 a gallon, an economic burden for many Americans. The American Petroleum Institute, which represents the industry, said in a statement that capacity has been diminished as the Biden administration has sought to move away from fossil fuels. In other News Digest news report, abortions in U.S. rose in 2020. The number and rate of U.S. abortions increased from 2017 to 2020 after a long decline, according to figures released on Wednesday. The report from the Guttmacher Institute, a research group that supports abortion rights, counted more than 930,000 abortions in the U.S. in 2020. That's up from about 862,000 abortions in 2017, when national abortion figures reached their lowest point since the 1973 U.S. Supreme Court ruling that legalized the procedure nationwide. About one in five pregnancies ended in abortion in 2020, according to the report, which comes as the Supreme Court appears ready to overturn the decision. Medications abortions, the two-drug combination sometimes called the abortion pill, account for 54% of U.S. abortions in 2020, the first time they made up more than half of abortions, Guttmacher went on to say. And in news briefs, Capitol Tour. The House committee investigating the January 6, 2021 insurrection released video on Wednesday of a Capitol tour led by Republican Representative Barry Louder Milk the day before the attack, showing participants taking photos of stairwells and tunnels. The panel renewed calls for Louder Milk to testify about the tour. Vaccines, COVID-19 shots for infants, toddlers, and preschoolers moved a step closer on Wednesday. The Food and Drug Administration advisors gave thumbs up to vaccines from Moderna and Pfizer for the littlest kids. Capitol riot. A federal judge on Wednesday convicted a Confederate flag-toting man, Kevin Seafried, and his adult son, Hunter, of charges that they stormed the U.S. Capitol together during the riot on January 6, 2021, to obstruct Congress from certifying the election. And they will be sentenced separately in September. Threat. A federal grand jury indicted a man who was found with a gun near the home of Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh after telling police he was planning to kill the justice, prosecutors said on Wednesday. Nicholas John Roski, age 26, was charged with attempting murder on a justice of the United States. Hinckley, John Hinckley Jr., who shot and wounded President Ronald Reagan in 1981, was freed from court oversight on Wednesday, officially concluding decades of supervision. The lifting of all restrictions had been expected since late September. And finally, in news briefs, officer, a Michigan police officer charged with murder after shooting Patrick Lioya in the back of the head, has been fired, officials said on Wednesday. Christopher Scher, a Grand Rapids officer, waived his right to a hearing and was dismissed, effective last Friday, the city manager said. And in other national news, if he's convicted on hate crimes, the state could seek execution. This is regarding the Buffalo shooting suspect being charged. In Buffalo, New York, the white gunman accused of killing 10 black people in a racist attack at a Buffalo supermarket was charged Wednesday with federal hate crimes that could potentially carry a death penalty. The criminal complaint filed Wednesday against Peyton Gendron coincided with a visit to Buffalo by Attorney General Merrick Garland. He met with the families of the people who were killed and placed a bouquet of white flowers at a memorial outside the Tops Friendly Market, which has been closed since the May 14th attack. No one in this country should have to live in fear that they will go to work or shop at a grocery store and will be attacked by someone who hates them because of the color of their skin, Garland went on to say at a news conference. Garland, who halted federal executions last year, did not rule out seeking the death penalty against Gendron, age 18. He said families and the survivors will be consulted as the Justice Department weighs whether to seek capital punishment. The federal hate crimes case is based partly on documents in which Gendron laid out his radical, racist worldview and extensive preparation for the attack, some of which he posted online and shared with a small group of people shortly before he started shooting. FBI agents executing a search warrant at Gendron's home found a note in which he apologized to his family and wrote he had to commit this attack because he cares for the future of the white race, according to an affidavit filed with the criminal complaint. Three children of 86-year-old victim Ruth Whitfield said that they told Garland at their private meeting that they wanted to make sure he didn't view the Buffalo shooting as a singular case. This is a problem throughout America, said one son, former Buffalo Fire Commissioner Garnell Whitfield Jr. Gendron's attorney, Brian Parker, declined to comment. So far, the evidence made public against Gendron suggests he acted alone, but Garland and Deputy FBI Director Paul Abate said that investigators were examining the gunman's communications with others prior to the shooting. And now turning to other news in San Francisco. San Francisco is declaring that the Internet Explorer finally being retired. Internet Explorer is finally heading out to pasture. As of Wednesday, Microsoft will no longer support the once-dominated browser that legions of web surfers love to hate, and a few still claim to adore. The 27-year-old application now joins BlackBerry phones, dial-up modems, and Palm Pilots in the dustbin of tech history. IE's demise was not a surprise. A year ago, Microsoft said that it was putting an end to Internet Explorer on June 15, 2022, pushing users to its Edge browser, which was launched in 2015. The company made clear then it was time to move on. Not only is Microsoft Edge a faster, more secure, and more modern browsing experience than Internet Explorer, but it is also able to address a key concern: compatibility for older legacy websites and applications, said Sean Lindersay, general manager of Microsoft Edge Enterprise, wrote in a May 2021 blog post. Users marked Explorer's passing on Twitter, with some referring to it as the top browser for installing other browsers. For others, it was a moment for 90s nostalgia memes, while Wall Street Journal quoted a 22-year-old who was sad to see IE go. Microsoft released the first version of Internet Explorer in 1995, the ante-diluvian era of web surfing dominated by the first widely popular browser, Netscape Navigator. Its launch signaled the beginning of the end of Navigator. Microsoft went on to tie IE and its ubiquitous Windows operating system together so tightly that many people simply used it by default instead of Navigator. The Justice Department sued Microsoft in 1997, saying it violated an earlier consent decree by requiring computer makers to use its browser as a condition of using Windows. It eventually agreed to settle the antitrust battle in 2002 over its use of its Windows monopoly to squash competitors. It also tangled with European regulators, who said that tying Internet Explorer to Windows gave it an unfair advantage over rivals such as Mozilla's Firefox, Opera, and Google Chrome. Users, meanwhile, complained that IE was slow, prone to crashing and vulnerable to hacks. IE's market share, which in the early 2000s was over 90%, began to fade as users found more appealing alternatives. Today, the Chrome browser dominates with roughly a 65% share of the worldwide browser market, followed by Apple's Safari with 19%, according to Internet Analytics company StatCounter. IE's Air Edge lags with about 4%, just ahead of Firefox. And in other news, Trump sees win, loss in South Carolina. In Washington, Donald Trump notched a significant victory in South Carolina, where his preferred candidate easily ousted five-term Representative Tom Rice, the first Republican to be booted from office after voting to impeach the former president last year. But another high-profile GOP target of Trump in the state, Representative Nancy Mace, held back a challenger. Meanwhile, in Nevada on Tuesday, two election deniers who have tirelessly promoted the former president's lies about voter fraud won their primaries for key positions of power in the state. Takeaways from the latest round of primary elections. Split decision in South Carolina. Rice and Mace have been objects of Trump's anger ever since a mob of his supporters stormed the U.S. Capitol to stop the certification of Joe Biden's presidential election win. Their transgressions? Well, Mace stated on national TV that Trump's entire legacy was wiped out by the attack, while Rice became an apostate for joining a small group of Republicans who voted with Democrats in favor of Trump's second impeachment. He threw a temper tantrum that culminated with the sacking of the United States Capitol, Rice told NBC News on Monday. It's a direct attack on the Constitution, and he should be held accountable. Voters ultimately rendered different judgments on the duo, reflecting a split within the GOP about how to move forward from the Trump era. Rice's largely rural district is representative of Trump's America, where crossing the former president carries a steep cost. Even as Trump railed against both lawmakers, he chose to hold a rally in Rice's district earlier this year. And that's because Mace's district, which centers on Charleston, is full of the type of moderate suburban voters who fled the GOP under Trump. It is one of the few districts in an overall red state where Democrats have been even moderately competitive in congressional races. The results demonstrate that the Trump factor can't be underestimated in solidly Republican territory. A potential warning sign for other Republicans, including Representative Liz Cheney of Wyoming, who also voted to impeach Trump and has helped lead the House panel investigating the January 6 attack. She's facing a competitive primary in August from a Trump-backed challenger. Another notable factor in the Mace contest, it amounted to a proxy battle between Trump, who is contemplating a 2024 White House campaign, and former UN Ambassador Nikki Haley, who was also considering a run. Trump-backed former state representative Katie Arrington in the race, which Haley, a former South Carolina governor, effectively challenged Trump by campaigning with Mace. In Rice's contest, Trump endorsed State Representative Russell Fry. Election deniers advance in Nevada. Two Republican candidates who ardently pushed Trump's lies about voter fraud costing him the 2020 presidential election won nominations to top offices in Nevada on Tuesday. Jim Marchant, a former state lawmaker, won the GOP nomination for Secretary of State, the office that oversees elections in the perennial presidential battleground that Trump narrowly lost in both 2016 and 2020. Marchant has made appearances around the country with other Trump allies, including MyPillow CEO Mike Lindell, to cast doubt on the election results, despite the fact that court's election officials have both parties and his own attorney general have said that the vote was legitimate. Marchant has also been working to persuade local officials to toss out voting equipment that he baselessly contends is rigged and instead require that all ballots be cast and counted by hand, an arduous and unnecessary task since testing is conducted before elections and audits are held afterward to ensure that votes are recorded accurately. Marchant will face Democratic Cisco Aguilar in November. Aguilar is a lawyer and former chair of the Nevada Athletic Commission who was unopposed in the Democratic primary. Adam Laxalt, the state's former attorney general, won the GOP nomination for U.S. Senate in November on Tuesday after promoting Trump's lies about fraud in the state in the 2020 election, including the spearheading legal challenge to the vote counting process. Laxalt, who was backed by the former president, weaved Trump's false claims of voter fraud throughout his campaign. He has already begun raising fears of voter fraud in this year's midterm elections and has talked about preemptively mounting legal challenges to try to tighten up the election. He had insisted in 2020 that ineligible and dead voters cast ballots in the presidential election in Nevada, despite the state's Republican Secretary of State, Barbin Siegavisk, insisting that the results showing Biden's victory were accurate and reliable. Siegavisk was prevented by term limit laws from running again. Laxalt will face Democratic Senator Catherine Cortez Masto in November in what Republicans see as one of their best chances to flip a seat and win back control of the chamber. Texas House seat flips. A once solidly Democratic district in South Texas will now be represented by a Republican after Mayra Flores won a special primary election to finish the term of former Democratic Representative Philmon Velva, who resigned this year to become a lobbyist. Flores, a GOP organizer who is the daughter of migrant workers, will only hold the seat for several months before the district is redrawn to be more favorable to Democrats. But her victory in the heavily Hispanic Rio Grande Valley is ominous signs for Democrats. They are not only losing ground in a region they long dominated, but Flores' success as a candidate also demonstrates that Republicans are making inroads with the Hispanic voters. Her win also has implications for Democrats' ambitions in Congress, denying House Speaker Nancy Pelosi an opportunity to add to her slim two-vote margin to pass legislation. And lastly, today on the program, how high will prices go? Several factors are converging to increase the cost of gasoline. There's little evidence that gasoline prices, which had a record $5 a gallon on June 11th, will drop anytime soon. Rising prices at the pump are a key driver in the highest inflation that Americans have seen in 40 years. Everyone seems to have a favorite villain for the high cost of filling up. Some blame President Joe Biden. Others say it's because of Russian President Vladimir Putin recklessly invading Ukraine. It's not hard to find people, including Democrats in Congress, who accuse oil companies of price gouging. As with many things in life, the answer can be complicated. So what's happening? Well, gas prices have been surging since April 2020, when the initial shock on the pandemic drove prices under $1.80 a gallon, according to government figures, and then they hit $3 in May 2021 and cruised past $4 in March. On June 11th, the nationwide average for a gallon ticked just above $5, a record, according to Auto Club AAA, which has tracked prices for years. The average price jumped 18 cents in the previous week and was $1.92 higher than this time last year. State averages range from $6.43 a gallon in California to $4.52 in Mississippi. So why is this happening? Several factors are coming together to push gasoline prices higher. Global oil prices have been rising unevenly, but sharply overall. Since December, the price of international crude has roughly doubled in that time, with the U.S. benchmark rising nearly as much, closing June 10th at more than $120 a barrel. Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the resulting sanctions by the U.S. and its allies have contributed to the rise. Russia is a leading oil producer. The U.S. is the world's largest oil producer, but U.S. capacity to turn oil into gasoline is down 900,000 barrels of oil per day since the end of 2019, according to the Energy Department. Tighter oil and gasoline supplies are hitting as energy consumptions rise because of the economic recovery. Finally, Americans typically drive more starting around Memorial Day, adding to the demand for gasoline. So the last question to ask here is, when will it end? It could be up to motorists themselves. By driving less, they would reduce demand and put downward pressure on prices. There has got to be some point where people start cutting back. I just don't know what the magic point is, said Patrick DeHaan, an analyst for the gas shopping app Gas Buddy. Is it going to be $5? Is it going to be $6 or $7? That's the million-dollar question that nobody can answer. And that does it for the reading of the Globe Gazette for June 16th, 2022. I am your reader, Pete Welch, and you have been listening to the reading of the Globe Gazette on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Thank you for listening. Bye-bye now.